You are listening to The Talking Show on K Chung Radio, Chinatown's only...
Only.
Only micro-broadcasting radio station. Before and whatever after means the COVID-19 pandemic.
I'd like to think that this pandemic will weed out some of the lesser micro-broadcasting radio stations in Chinatown. who just don't have the sort of like institutional roots that K-Chung right. does in order to survive.
Yeah, the same way that that micro broadcasting station backed by Bear Stearns fully collapsed
mm-hmm.
back in 2009. We outlasted that whole mess.
Yes, the Bear Stearns micro broadcasting Red Bull radio station did close.
Yeah, exactly.
It gave me a little bit of pleasure, although, you know, I don't like to see good radio engineers unemployed. You know, Gunter had friends who worked over there, and it was hard for him to find spots for them at K-Chung because, you know, there's only so much to do.
Well, you know, good thing we put all our eggs in the Citibank.
Yes.
The good people at Citibank have kept this institution afloat.
Yes. Oh boy, thank you, Citibank. Wait, is there news about Citibank that I'm missing? Or
no,
is it, they're just a hilarious bank.
And they came out without a scratch, I think, during that whole.
Yeah, right, exactly. They just that's right, they got the best deal out of 2008 or something like that. Or they got their deal first or something, right? Like they got
Yeah, there was I feel like Lehman and Bear Stearns got hit hard.
Yeah.
But then it was clear in the aftermath that everyone was holding a steaming bag of shit. It's just, you know, there were a few sacrifices.
Oh, no, I know what it was. It was that the guys at Citibank knew early enough and sold.
Oh, right.
Like on the moment of failure, basically, like, dumped their poo-poo to, like, the other guys. I think it's the topic of the movie Margin Call, basically.
Okay, yeah. So they made the right... they got it off their books right in time.
They were the only ones to do that, but then like it made them also like, you know, like such as there is solidarity in high finance, I think it really destroyed lots of friendships.
Yeah.
Wall Street.
Also was one of the banks was selling all the shorts.
I think that's
was shorting the mortgage market. Maybe it was Citibank.
Yeah, that's because that's the only way that they could sell it. I think that's the same story. I think that's what Citibank yeah. did, and that's how they got.
Well, and then
that's how they
and they won the battle.
Yeah, totally. And they got rid of all the stuff and they partially began like dropping the price. I guess basically, they pushed it closer off the edge sooner by shorting it, and then people were like, "Why are they shorting it?" And they all took like a second look and were like, "Ah."
What do you think the next like fundamental human need as it was shelter in that case, like what will the next one be?
I mean, we've already got it, dude. It's lungs.
Healthcare?
Yeah, it's lungs, it's yeah. like it's like, or I guess it's also like now a heart disease, and like what is it that children are getting as a version of coronavirus? Hashimoto syndrome or something?
Yeah, killer hornets.
Yeah, and then murder hornets. Although, like, the market is bullish on murder. You should get in on the ground floor of murder hornets. The minute that Obama comes back in power, we're sending those to Afghanistan with drones, and it's going to be amazing.
I read a great overheard in L.A. Quote. Somebody said to another person, "Can you believe that species has murder hornets?" And the person said, "Well, of course, we have human murderers."
I suppose it's true, right? Like, yeah. There are murder humans.
What kind of species has a whole section that are murderous?
And you're like,
all species?
Maybe, right? Yeah. It's like you definitely think that there's like some obligate carnivores. You know, you'd like to think that they just eat when they're hungry, kill when they're hungry or something like that. But like, mm-hmm. we've all seen cats just jamming on some creature, just ripping it apart and like kind of not being hungry clearly, or being like, "I tore it apart because it was fun, but it's gross. I don't eat this. This is a gross thing to eat."
Right.
I'm holding out until you come with the wet food.
I just wanted to null their body parts.
Yeah. I didn't even kill it. It's just very wounded.
Speaking of cats.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's my one of my cats, Jeff. It's his birthday today. He's
happy birthday, 4. Jeff.
The big 4.0.
Seems like yesterday, really 4 years old.
It's true. I mean, to be fair, when you say that they do grow up so fast with cats, it's quite true. It takes about a year. So there's that. But yeah, no, he's actually, you know, he's had quite a rough couple days. I don't know if this is well, first of all, yesterday there was a very intense day of thunder and lightning all day.
Oh my goodness.
Which is dramatic. And the plants all look incredible. And, but the thunder and lightning, and there was thunder and lightning quite close by, you know, like when the lightning and the thunder are really almost happening on top of each other. And so the thunder was really loud, you know, like window shaking at some points. And, this is the kind of thing that Jeff does not like. So he hid under the bed all yesterday. And then have they made it to Los Angeles yet? Have the Blue Angels flown over your city to congratulate, I don't know, long-term care facilities and senior citizens for piling up with corpses or whatnot? Like, have they?
They have not.
Well, it's so that happened today, I think, in honor of medical staff. But I would also like to add, you know, my cat's birthday.
I think that they've been forbidden to come here because, you know, of all of the ardent Dodgers fans here can't stand the word angel.
Oh, they can only fly over Anaheim?
Yeah. If there was like a Blue Dodgers jet battalion, then I think that we would get that. But here, no, they're going to send them down to Orange County.
It's funny because it's like, it's kind of the worst of all possible worlds, right? Because the Angels are a red in color. Blue connotes the Dodgers. So really, the Blue Angels can't win in Los Angeles because it's either, they're like sort of, on the one hand being like, yeah, the Angels, and the Dodgers fans are like, no way. And then the Angels fans wearing their dumb red caps are like, the Dodgers, but it's blue, no. But the red ain't, no. So yeah, I guess it's, to be fair, Southern California in general, not beloved by the administration. I don't think they're going to celebrate, going to help Southern California celebrate at all. Whereas in Texas, you know, they love it here. The state's reopening. You need what you need when you're going back to work for the first time in a long time in the middle of a public health pandemic, which has not been addressed in any meaningful way after you bought the health services time by isolating for 2 months, is to be buzzed by low-flying military aircraft, which will terrify your cat.
We'll just get like drones to fill in.
Yeah, right. Yeah, or even better, just like they'll just green screen them in and tell you saw them.
And they'll be like branded by one of Elon Musk's companies or something.
Yeah.
It's like the new Tesla Angels.
Yeah, we get the Tesla Angels. They just
Tesla Dodgers.
They emit a sound that just sounds like Grimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ooh. But so it was Jeff's birthday, and Jeff did not like the airplanes.
Hurrah! Oh,
yeah. It's the kind of thing that sounds very much like thunder, which is the thing that he experienced yesterday, and the thing he's experiencing today is a sort of man-made thunder. But you know, compared to the weather, it's bright and sunny outside. So it's a beautiful day to see an airplane go by in a fraction of a second. It doesn't last very long, which is one thing you can say about the Blue Angels. It's, they're somewhere else now. They're,
yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, your dad was in the Air Force, right? So did he get to fly those airplanes?
No, I think that they're a Navy thing. If I remember correctly,
how do they? Can you just give me some background here? My layman's understanding is that the Navy is about boats,
right? But they have an Air Force as well, or maybe they're just part of the Air Force proper. I can't say.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, each wing of the military has its own Air Force, and then there is the Air Force.
How does the Air Force feel about that?
I don't know. I think so. My dad flew for the Marines,
which isn't the Air Force.
No. Nor is it.
You're
the
blowing my mind. You're blowing my mind. Okay. Do continue.
So the Marines traditionally are the front line of foot soldier attack.
I see. So you send a boat over, and then so it's just
or you send a plane full of them, and so
full of sailors who know about boats.
No, full of Marines who know about hand to hand combat.
I see.
So in order to tailor the flights and the flying style to the needs of bare knuckled boxers,
called
Marines. They've got a handful of people who fly the planes for them, like the planes with big bellies that carry people.
Right. I see.
Or helicopters and whatnot. You know, the kind of the glamorized air battles that you see in Top Gun, I think, are for the Navy and Air Force.
And so why do the Navy get to do the fighter jets? Because it may all right. So
you have aircraft carriers, right?
But like, it seems like you have the aircraft carriers to have those aircraft. Like, if you just have boats in general, and leave the fighter jets to the Air Force, why do you need an aircraft carrier?
I guess because those planes can't fly terribly long, right?
Right. I see. Yeah.
So you want to attack Japan? Not that we've ever done that before. you got to get the planes within a mile or so.
I see.
And then launch them off the ship.
And then you send them towards Japan, and then they launch missiles at some strategic targets, I guess?
I guess so, yeah. Which, I don't think it's how they do things anymore. But at some point, that was how it worked.
I see.
Because I think like most things that travel extremely fast, they burn fuel very fast.
Right, yeah.
Like Ferraris and whatnot.
Yeah.
So they have to... Although, like that incredible scene in the opening of the Batman movie with Bane, there are those planes that refuel the other planes.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are truly benevolent planes.
Yeah.
We don't kill anyone here.
Just helping people out.
We just feed people in need.
It would be cool if those planes were like just international. Like they would just be doing like rounds. Mm-hmm. And you could go if you were like running low in your plane, you could just go over there and fill up.
Yeah, exactly.
You're like, oh, well, I'll make it in time to get over to this plane. That'll be fine.
And there'd be like little floating bars.
You can get some pretzels.
Take a break, get some pretzels and drink.
Yeah. So your dad never... I'm still not entirely like so the you're telling me that mm-hmm. the divisions of the armed forces are largely based on time and not and like proximity of engagement and not based on sort of fields of warfare. Like that's not so the Air Force isn't just about air, it's about like when they get involved, and the Marines are involved first. Like you send them physically over there, and then the Navy mm-hmm. is like a little more distanced, and then the Air Force is most distanced, I guess, is the point.
I'm not sure, and I don't even know when they became distinguishable factions. Like I don't imagine in the First World War that they had all of these different groups, but I have no idea.
I think that the British had a Royal Air Force because they mm-hmm. the all the sort of Red Baron dogfight in the sky stuff, it's all about the Royal Air Force. I know this only from Snoopy comics, but I understand that to be set in World War One.
True. Okay.
Yeah, that kind of aerial combat.
Because then there's also the Army. I don't even know what they do.
Yeah. So if the Marines are the ones that you're dropping off on the beach, and that's why you had to like carry them over with a helicopter,
or a boat.
Yeah, or a boat. The Army's already there. They spread out of the ground like mushrooms, or do they have a Navy and an Air Force as well that drops them off on the beach too?
perhaps the Marines plow the beach and then the Army sets up shop, because the Army because the Army trains out. I feel like I have the most intimate knowledge of that group, because the Army is what trains out in 29 Palms, right?
Is it?
That's also Marines. Oh, I can't even keep it straight. Maybe they're all just part of the same thing. Maybe it's not as it's more amorphous than we realize.
I confess true and utter ignorance. I have.
What is there in Canada?
Well, we have all these things. I have a cousin who's in the, I want to say, the Army.
Okay.
And he joined, he volunteered. He wanted to become an officer. You know, he went through, I think, officer training. I think he's going to be a corporal.
I don't know what that means.
Yeah, I don't know either. But I was speaking to my mom on Mother's Day, and she was giving me the full family update. It's very obscure to me what that specifically entails. You know, how this affects his life, or how it changes what it is that he's doing for Canada, one way or the other. I think for a long time he was in charge of procurement, which meant that, like, you know, he was like locating the things that the Army would buy.
Okay.
So he was like an office manager, basically, I think, in sort of larger terms, maybe he was procuring, you know, ammunition or something as well, or more, you know, more than just keeping. And obviously, like, an Army base is a big operation. Like, it's, I'm not trying to belittle my cousin's work.
Could you convince him to procure artworks by contemporary artists?
Oh, interesting. We haven't spoken in probably something like 15 to 20 years. I think ten years, maybe.
One of your cousins into becoming an art collector for the
military.
Canadian Army.
I think his tastes are pretty revanchist. I think, if my understanding is correct, he does actually enjoy going to flea markets and collecting curios and objets d'art, but they largely tend towards military history. Such as photography of it's funny that I do know this, actually. I do know about his collecting habits. My uncle tells me that my uncle told my mom, who told me that, this uncle being his father, that he had found a photographic view of the base that he serves on from the late 1800s, which is, I guess, how long this base has been established. And it's from almost exactly the view from his window, but from, you know, more than 100 years ago or something. And and this pleased him very much, I'm told.
I bet.
It's cool. I also get off on the historical views.
Like the historical views of CalArts that were floating around.
You know, that's nice. Yeah. And I like to see, old Los Angeles.
Sure.
You know, because in a way things change a lot and then they don't change very much, and I guess that's the case with everything, and so it's enjoyable. And I've recently begun sort of assembling a folder of I don't know if you have had much experience of this. I don't know if it was a popular building style where you grew up, but in the 80s and 90s, I guess in the 70s and 80s, really, they were building malls with sort of brown brick. Do you know? Do you have any memories of this? It would be like the mall would be faced in brick. It would be darker and more cave-like, and then there would be sort of like chandeliers, not particularly grand chandeliers, but there would be sort of like chandeliers and light fixtures and such, and sconces that would illuminate the proceedings inside. But there would be sort of this polished brown brick. Tile, I guess, on the floor, and there would be brown brick walls. And this was
I think the malls in Dallas are like that.
Yeah, and there'd maybe be a central elevator area that would take you up to, like, if there was a mall with a professional tower on top of it or something like that, you know, like that would take you up the center of that.
It'd be a glass elevator, and it kind of overlooked open area in the middle of the mall.
Yeah, exactly, with a water feature, but otherwise it would be like very bricky and dark and cave-like. And I have a lot of nostalgia about that. I enjoy views of those. And many, because many of those have been demolished. First of all, like, malls have been dying. And then if they aren't already dead, I imagine COVID-19 has, like, well and truly stomped on the neck of most mall retail now. And then I guess people didn't enjoy going into shopping caves. I think they wanted them to look more like mega churches, I think. You know, with, like, airy and full of light, so they would have, like, profuse skylights overhead instead. As opposed to the sort of cave and vine style. So anyway, I like a historical... so much as to say that I do like a historical view. And look at these pictures and fondly think about how things have changed.
Oh, have they?
You were saying earlier that that there was, like, that the stealth bomber, the F-14, I think, stealth bomber was like the number one plane of your childhood.
Yeah, that was the one that really struck me. Its design, its prestige.
Yeah,
it was wrapped in mystery.
It's true.
Nobody really knew, and I remember my dad saying that it flew at the edge of the atmosphere, which of course is still painfully abstract to me.
Yeah,
as to what that means and what challenges that presents to flight.
Yeah.
I know that birds try not to go up there, so why should we be doing that?
It's hard to breathe.
But then also that it was fully able to evade radar, and that in part because of the faceting of the exoskeleton.
Yeah, it would send the signals back in a weird way.
Yeah, just at the wrong angle.
Yeah,
you know, because you're hoping to bounce the waves off of it, and that a good portion of them come back towards you. And
yeah, and you can detect
depending
them
on the distance between when you shot them and when they come back, you can tell where the thing is.
Yeah,
and how big it is. But you know, if the wave gets splintered in a million directions, it's harder to read. That was fascinating to me as a kid, and still as an adult.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? That sort of like principles of acoustic design were just applied to us, like the shape of an object.
Right.
You know, exactly. And that it's not at all about how it, like, it's so important how this thing sounds if you yell at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you send a high energy sound at it, what you hear back, what the echo sounds like is so important. It is like right. A really strange sort of entry in musical history. The surface of the stealth bomber.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically an anechoic chamber.
But like inside out.
You yell at it and you hear nothing. Yeah, you hear nothing.
And so the stealth bomber, I guess the thing is that, like, growing up in the 80s, the stealth bomber was sort of released in the 80s.
For the Cold War.
Yeah, just to finish up the Cold, wrap it up, put a bow on the Cold War, to scare the shit out of the Soviet Union. And of course, the Cold War wrapped up, like, I think, like 10 minutes after the bomber came out. Like, I think they released it in 88, and then, you know, in 89, the Berlin Wall falls down. And, you know, like, it had at that point been, like, the most expensive military contract in history. Things that, you know, stuff like this. So I was like, but I remember it well. Because it was such a strange shape, such an abstract triangle, and it was all black. You know,
yeah,
it was.
It looked kind of like so much of the design for the Batman movies.
Yeah, yeah, it was very fancy. But later on a road trip with some friends, we stopped for gas in Tonopah, Nevada. Have you heard of this place?
No. Were they the only people to down a stealth bomber?
Quite the opposite. They were the military or Air Force base near there, which is, you know, I think actually the same base that has Area 51 on it. You know, it's like, I think all of the interior of Nevada is just one large sort of experimental base. And Tonopah's near one edge of this. And at one point, almost the entire population of the town, you know, was involved in working on the base in some way. And they had all signed non-disclosure agreements to not talk about what they were doing at work. Even though all of them were building the stealth bomber.
By about a third of the X-Files episodes.
Yeah.
They're always in like some Nevada town.
Right.
Everyone's been subjected to some kind of like, you know, subsonic sound that turns their guts into, I don't know, liquid or something like
that. Yeah, and no one can talk about it.
Right.
But yeah, so this is exactly true, is that like people were actively discouraged from looking at the sky. Like there was, you know, and it was the biggest industry in town. And then of course the idea was that like this is where they were building the stealth bombers in secrecy, but once the sort of unveiling had occurred, then, you know, the government was going to ramp up and build tons of them, you know, and they'd just be like soaring silently out of our visible, you know, invisibly in the troposphere, protecting every, you know, all and sundry. But it never worked out because they canceled the program shortly after it was unveiled, and it costs, you know, like a bajillion dollars for one to take off and fly for a second. You know, like they can't afford to fly them and they can't afford to repair them. Because of course the parts were never made in great quantity. And so it sort of just ripped the heart out of this little town of Tonopah. But that at the same time, for most of the good years, I guess, or post Gold Rush good years, no one could talk about why they were good years. It was like just amazing that the entire town was sworn to secrecy when everyone was employed, gainfully employed, and everyone was prosperous. No one could say why, you know, like
or make large purchases.
Yeah. You know, like it was just one of those things, or look up. This is just incredible. And the reason why we know all this is that there was a motel on the main drag. Tonopah is a pretty big town for, you know, rural Nevada. And pretty nice too. There's an old Gold Rush hotel that was restored, and next to the fancy hotel is a motel called the Tonopah Motel. And the lady there is a very high functioning weirdo who has a binder of things to do in and know about Tonopah, and every page is marked like, do not take this page, ask for a copy at the office.
Wow.
Like, you are not supposed to take pages out of the binder. And on the front page,
do you have to sign an NDA when you ask for a page?
Well, no, now you don't.
Okay.
But because, you know, it's all out in the open. But but like the best part was that one of the like 10 things you could do in Tonopah is stay in your room and read your binder.
I was on the list?
Yeah, it's on her list. The binder is thick. Like this to be completely honest, this woman has done like an incredible job of local history and compiling and photocopying it. Because it is like an inch, you know, like I feel like I moved to Los Angeles and there was like, you know, partially there's like a deliberate effort of forgetting where it's like, no, you're experiencing all this for the first time, you know, this has never happened before. Wow. You know, like, but like there isn't even a pamphlet. They don't tell you how to get around. They don't explain any of it to you. They're not like, oh yeah, though that's that thing you think you can access is in fact extremely far away. You know, like the it's never explained to you, it's never made clear to you. You just pull up into town and they let you loose. And maybe you can find a Trader Joe's and get something to eat. But like the idea that like someone would like you'd pull into town and they would literally give you like an inch worth of documents about the town should you be interested is, I think, like genuinely fantastic. I wish more people would do that. And it wasn't just like Chamber of Commerce, you know, because sometimes they'll give you a binder, but the binder will just be like, you know, eat at the steakhouse down the street, right. You know,
eat at our lobbyist joint.
Yeah, exactly. Take a river cruise with my cousin. And
or like the steakhouse and surgery ads you see in the airplane magazines.
Wait, together?
No, well, but it's always like the same four or five steakhouses and same surgeons and dental hygiene or practitioners.
That's right.
They're like, you know, we've got offices in Philadelphia, New York, Dallas, Los Angeles.
Who are these people?
I don't know. And then it's high-end steakhouses.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, American Way.
Yeah. It is like indicative of who they think is flying.
True.
people who can afford to go to... I keep getting... Speaking of steakhouses and Los Angeles, I keep getting heartbreaking emails from Pacific Dining Car.
Oh, no. How are they doing?
Oh, I think they're doing generally... I mean, I can't imagine that... that they're doing too badly, right? Because it's obviously some sort of weird front, first of all.
Yeah, and you hope businesses like that own their building.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, we've been here since 1912. We just never...
We've been paying Murray rent the whole time. Yeah.
Now we're paying Murray the Third rent.
Yeah, exactly. No, I assume that they've got low overhead. I assume that, you know, like obviously, like I'm sure that the meat itself is like expensive cuts or whatever, but like there's no way it's anything close to what they're charging for it.
No.
So, you know, they've been doing really well for a long time. I imagine that they can continue to do well, but just that they're just like trying to get you to order a steak dinner to go.
Yeah, it doesn't travel so well.
It doesn't. It really doesn't. It's like one of the things where like, and I have a great deal of affection for Pacific Dining Car, and you know, I would love to, I would, in, you know, if another stimulus check ever came out or whatever, I would like consider it, you know, if you could go eat there, but you shouldn't. not in the short term, and then like not till they figure out how to keep everyone safe. And then in the medium term, you know, I do not want to like sit in my car and eat a steak at that moment when it's actually good.
Eat a cold $60 steak at home.
Yeah. Like all the existing. And so it's just one of those things where they're trying to tell you that it will be fun.
Yeah. You know what should come back is like the 50s style burger drive-in. That should come back on force.
Isn't that back anyway? Isn't that like kind of what happens? I guess not. Like Sonic isn't exactly like that.
No, but like, yeah, they should like, you know, go all the way and get the thing that clips onto the side of your door.
Yeah.
You know, and so that like the tray of food just sits right there. And
did we talk about
this? You're basically 6 feet apart anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And like drive-in movie theaters and such should also come back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Have we talked about this? That, like, I went to a P. Terry's and it was kind of like that with the tray. They would like handle the tray, to you, but you would like put everything on a sterilized tray and they would like shoot whatever you handed to them with disinfectant.
You know, I could see some, clever Texas entrepreneur designing 6x6 foot trays.
Uh-huh.
So just as you walk around with them, you can't get... It's like we've solved this problem Texas style.
Yeah,
with
suspenders in the middle or something like that, and you just sort of walk around.
Yeah, it's like you can't get within 6 feet of each other because the tray is 6 feet.
Yeah, wow, it is bigger in Texas.
If you can eat the whole tray, it's free.
Yeah.
I still had never been to one of those places where if you eat the, you know, the absurdly large steak, then it's free. And if you don't, it's you know, prohibitively expensive.
I've been to a couple places like this where it's like, if you, they've never been steak places. It's always been like, if you order the Eradicator nachos and eat the whole thing, it's free. Or like if you eat the like 2 pound hamburger, it's free.
Have you gone for it?
I've done the hamburger and I've done the nachos.
And it was free? You finished?
Yep. Yep.
Was it difficult?
Yes. yeah, it was. I'm a pretty good eater. I think I inherited from my father just sort of like a limitless capacity, even if it mm-hmm. even if it's not, in fact, it's more like limited contemporary awareness is maybe the situation. You know, like I'm not aware enough when it's happening to prevent the discomfort that occurs basically immediately afterwards.
Right. Okay.
Like, cause some people I think feel bad while it's happening and then they stop themselves, and I don't have that. I just keep going until I'm eventually destroyed from overconsumption. This is true of like pretty much everything I can fit in my mouth. Yeah. So yeah, I just keep going and going and going. And then I stop, and then, especially with like eating like the giant hamburger or whatever, like you literally feel like you're going to die. but no, it's true. Like I've successfully, done at least two or three of these things. There was like a submarine place I remember as well. I like it when they sort of just give you too much, and expect nothing of you. Like there was a submarine store called Admirals in Brantford, Ontario, which is the home of Wayne Gretzky. And if you ordered the fries, they would just give you like a pillowcase full of fries. And they were like pretty good fries. They were also like very tasty fries. And so like you would want to eat a lot of them because it's very enjoyable. But then like at a certain point, you'd just be like, holy shit, they're cold. Like there's still tons left. And there was no pressure for you to finish them. They were just like, listen, kid, here you go. $4? Thanks. Here's literally like an entire lap full of fries. Like, knock yourself out, you know, like, but, you know, there was no evaluative framework, you know, like, I feel like that's the thing about like finishing stuff as they're like, then they have to evaluate you, you know, and Admirals was just like, do your own thing, man. You be you.
Right, we're just going to provide the opportunity.
Yeah,
for lower abdominal pain.
Eat as much or as little as you want. You know, it's up to you. Make the choice, which I appreciate.
That ethos is not really part of L.A. Southern California culinary experience.
No,
it's more like here's your leaf of kale. Don't ask for anything else.
Totally, There was a place, a ramen place, that's actually, funnily enough, featured in many, it's featured in Star Trek Discovery and The Expanse, because it has sort of futuristic wooden walls, and it's, so it's used as a location for all the science fiction places that film in Toronto, for shows that film in Toronto. But they have this annoying thing they do where if you finish your bowl of ramen, and like finishing a whole bowl of ramen is not like, this is not the like Eradicator nachos or like the colon destroyer burger or whatever, like it's totally reasonable if you're hungry to eat an entire, I think it's entirely reasonable to eat an entire bowl of ramen if you're hungry, and so you finish the ramen, but then they'll like stamp your card, and if you like finish like five of them, you get a freebie. So you're kind of done eating, but you have to like stick around till someone comes over and gives you your marks.
Mm.
And then they take a picture of you.
Oh, upon finishing the card.
Yeah. Oh no. Upon finishing the ramen. And so like there's like these,
for all five stamps or whatever.
Yeah. So, well, for anyone who finishes the whole bowl, they come over with a Polaroid camera, take a picture of you, and put on this like giant wall of people who have eaten the whole bowl, which again seems like, you know, it's like, could you imagine getting a trophy if you just like threw a ball in the air, a couple feet in the air, and caught it with the same hand or something like that? Like, it doesn't seem that remarkable, you know?
Is the wall pretty full?
The wall's very full. And I would eat there maybe like, because it's pretty good. Like, I'd eat there maybe like twice a month when I live nearby.
Oh, so
in
you're
Toronto
up there quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, because it's like, cause it was kind of on it was convenient.
Are
as
you
well
now buried though in like several hundred layers,
like
of
likely now, but there was a time, you know, when I was literally,
but would they, I'm asking, would they clear the board or would they
I don't know how it works.
Okay. Because I wonder the same thing about the board of shame at the bodega gas station.
Oh, China God, town. That place is amazing. I miss it so much.
But they clear that every year or so.
I mean, because presumably, like, the people... Like, it is, like, an incredible art show that like, they're called rats.
Yeah, everyone's a rat. And it's whatever they've stolen plus rat.
Yeah, like...
So it's like Twinkie rat.
Twinkie rat.
Gum rat.
Gum rat. Yeah. Arizona iced tea rat.
Yeah, exactly. I really want to get up there as kombucha rat. Or like Stumptown cold brew rat.
Like maybe when you eventually like leave Chinatown behind, finally, you know, when you are like
going there and
one last time.
And I would just tell the guys like, hey, I just want to end up on the board. I'm going to walk out with this. Okay.
Take my picture.
Yeah. No, well, they don't. They just like some panopticon in the back
is
just watching the footage. Because you wonder, like, if they're so efficient at catching people stealing things on this camera, why don't they just stop them?
Well, I think the way it works.
Is it because there's like a 5-minute delay on the feed and he's like, oh, they just.
No, I think it's just to avert
my system.
Avert violence, right? And then you're just not allowed in there again.
I see. Like, yeah, because if they confront them, they probably had like. Several altercations.
Yeah, whereas like if you, because it's like facing the door, right? So if you're sitting there at the counter and you're looking at the door and a guy comes through the door and he looks like the guy whose picture's next to the door.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like an effective system.
You say, kombucha rat, and make you turn around.
Yeah. It's more about public shame. There was an incredible gas station in Alpine, Texas.
Uh-huh.
And you know, like, I don't think they have these registers so often anymore, but some of them had like a small... LED screen that faced the customer.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And usually it just showed up the price or whatnot.
Yeah.
Well, at this register, it just said, you know, like, so-and-so is a goat thief.
What?
And it just scrolled constantly when you were checking out for years and years. And I finally asked the guy what it was, and I guess one of the owners, or the ower had a goats, and someone in the town had stolen it, and he knew it was him, and he wouldn't give the goat back, so he just... publicly shamed him on that little LED monitor.
So, and everyone in town, I guess, would have to go through the...
Yeah, it's like, yeah, when they go in there to pay for their gas, they're like, yeah. Oh, yeah, Anthony DeSimone is a goat thief.
Wow. That's or good. It's nice to... It's, you know, it's... We've been talking about having problems getting motivated to work and to make one's own work and to... read and watch movies and all of that stuff. It's harder with the corona, and I feel like now I'm kind of becoming more productive, or I'm learning how it is that I could be more productive. So I'm like actually kind of doing stuff today. Today's been a pretty good day. Good. And in general, you know, things are working out better in general, but the, I think it's inspiring that these guys at the gas station, you know, saw that they had like one canvas that they could operate on to get the message out. You know, like it's not like go buy another sign. It's like you've already got the resources. You know, don't put up a lawn sign out front that says, you know, a folding A-frame that says like so-and-so is a goat thief. You know, like just get it where like everyone has to look at it eventually. Yeah, no, it's really, it's...
Wow, but if he had stolen it from the gas station in Chinatown, his picture up there, and it would say goat rat.
I mean, could you imagine if the Chinatown gas station sold goats?
Oh, or, you know what would be even better than kombucha? Would be one of those, like, kind of, like, disturbing spinning taquitos or whatever.
Yeah, taquito rat.
Or, like, yeah, taquito rat or hot, like, a spinning hot dog rat.
You ever eat one of those?
No.
I never have either. I'm curious.
It's too much. Too much for me.
I feel like that's a kind of food that won't exist anymore. Like, I feel like LA Public Health is not going to allow you to have, like, a perpetually on-display taquito.
I feel like that's the kind of food that shouldn't have existed before the coronavirus.
But, I mean, like, I think now it will just be illegal.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Like there's probably like a family business that have been, you know, profiting off of the taquito all this time. And they're wondering like, how will we make rent? What are we going to do? Orders are way down. And they're like, well, but maybe when this is over, people will go back to buying taquitos. And like, no, they won't.
No. Hopefully they, you know, they're going to merge with Ruth Chris's Steakhouse.
Right.
Yeah. Their bailout money we used to buy the little guy, the taquito spinning company.
We use that great technology now inside our steaks.
Right.
Yeah. We stripped them down for parts. We acquired their secrets, their taquito secrets.
Well, speaking of mergers and acquisitions, I watched Pretty Woman last night for the first time in decades.
Oh, wow. So this is a break from erotic thrillers.
Yeah, but I feel like romantic comedy is not too far off from the genre.
Like they're closely related.
Yeah, I guess one of the first essential difference that comes to mind is whether or not the sex is consensual. Unfortunately.
Yeah, or just like how intense it is.
True.
Right. Or like
or whether or not it's pictured at all.
Or how delayed it is, right? Like or it occurs like at the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. But yeah, okay. So what are your conclusions?
Well, I was wondering, have you seen it as an adult?
I feel like I've seen portions of it on TV. But
I was just surprised.
That was a long
time
ago.
It's these kind of films where like I saw you see them as a kid or as a teen and you remember what you're supposed to remember.
Yeah,
right?
the moments.
Yeah,
the shopping scene, the
Rodeo Drive. Yeah, and that she's a prostitute and he's a wealthy guy. But how he's wealthy, like all of the backdrop that every film needs, just totally evaporates for me.
Yeah. I have no memory of any of that.
So Richard Gere is like a powerful mergers and acquisitions guy from New York who's come out to L.A. to acquire a shipbuilding company based in Long Beach.
No way.
Yeah, which is bizarre. And then there's like all of these high-powered business meetings overlooking the port of Los Angeles.
No way.
And his lawyer lives in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
And it's just a very peculiar, by our time, very peculiar representation of L.A.
Huh, just because like the lawyer would still be in Beverly Hills maybe, but like the... just
right, but it has nothing to do with the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
It's like you don't... You know, it's not like a Hollywood starlet staying at a fancy hotel.
Right, right.
On the West Side. It's just like a business guy.
Yeah.
Also, he takes her on a date and charters a flight to San Francisco to see the opera, which is a funny jab at,
LA.
Culturalist Los Angeles.
Yeah. That is funny.
Yeah. Because you're like, there is an opera like 30 minutes from you. Okay, well, whatever. You know, whatever.
Yeah, get
you
on your plane, dude. Do your thing. Yeah, because right, like I suppose like the way it would normally work is the guy would stay near the airport. In reality.
Yeah, exactly.
He'd stay near the airport, he'd get driven down to the port, do the business. Mm-hmm. The lawyer who does port business is probably located next to the port.
Yeah.
You know, like has mm-hmm. like the nicest office in San Pedro.
Right.
But yeah, that's interesting. I too had a great experience with sort of bygone Los Angeles in fiction. I read the subgenre of sort of loosely horror fiction called weird tales, largely Lovecraftian genre.
Is it for like young adults?
I think broadly speaking, but you know, generally like Lovecraft is the sort of archetypal entrant.
Okay.
So it's like sort of cosmic Edgar Allan Poe, you know, so sort of horror, cosmic horror, science fiction, you know, these kind of things.
Okay.
And there's this Lovecraft disciple called Fritz Leiber who wrote a short story called The Black Gondolier. And it's about Venice when during beatnik times. And it's great. It's all about sort of like petrochemical Los Angeles and this in true sort of Lovecraftian style. You know, the things don't happen to him. Something happens to sort of like a slightly more eccentric, more well-read friend of his. who is sort of a marginal figure, who is who has all the experiences and experiences all the terror, and then the narrator just discovers, you know, the remains. Is the, the narrator's there for the punchline, where like, and at the end I saw that he had been da 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 da, you know, like that's sort of the role, you know, but plays a sort of reasonable doubter, you know, like, oh, it can't be all that bad, or like, I heard his fantastic ravings, you know, and then we moved on the topic of conversation onto, you know, baseball or whatever, you know. It's really great. It's just like it's mostly about tar and like petrochemical sort of underpinnings of Los Angeles and the settlement of Los Angeles and how all the Spanish names refer, you know, La Brea and La Cienega, sort of all refer to this sort of bubbling miasmal identity. And the idea that his acquaintance has is that the tar is sentient.
Oh, okay.
And that it's not that we discover oil, it's that the oil calls to us and wants us to find it and wants us to, you know, like, so it's like, cause, and it has sort of like a proto environmental message as well. But it kind of makes sense. You know, like, why would you continue to use this product against your, all indications that you should, you know, and like, it's because like the oil wants you to. The oil is a sinister force that controls humanity and wants it to be used. And the black gondolier comes and gets this guy at the end. Yeah, who's just like a oil slime fish man.
Yikes.
Yeah, it's pretty... But like he goes on long sort of invocations of like the history of sort of occult Los Angeles, you know, where he's like, it's not surprising that so-and-so would believe this given, you know, and then he runs through like the entire sort of to that point history of weirdos in Los Angeles. And then sort of weaves that together with the history of the, you know, petrochemical industry in Los Angeles, which is like, you know, Occidental Petroleum and the Hammer Museum and all of that. So it's like, it's pretty good. And maybe it's just cause I'm homesick and, you know, and also the sort of weird way of real estate being developed, like how Venice is this sort of, tacky simulacrum that is also like a development scheme that then, you know, just literally becomes its own actual place as a result of existing long enough. And then oil comes out of it. And then, you know, all this other stuff. It's really, it was a really nice read, but also just like, yeah, a version of Los Angeles that's like kind of impossible to imagine, you know, like Ray Bradbury is from Los Angeles and he's from the West Side, but he would like commute, I presume by streetcar, I guess, to the Central Library to do research every day. You know, and like this was a way that people used the city. You know, like,
yeah,
like it's not the idea that like this dude from Venice is like going to the Central Library and hitchhiking back, is like not. You know, it's like believable to me, I guess, in this other version of how the city would have worked, even though those things seem so far apart. I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting.
I saw someone was doing, you know, everyone's been hopping on the online screenings bandwagon.
Oh, boy.
Which, you know, I'm not against.
Yeah.
I wish that this happened during peace times.
But, yeah, totally.
Whatever. But someone was doing a screening series on films about LA.
Uh-huh.
And I was surprised that there are four and I'd only heard of two of them. And these are like, you know, kind of video essays or essayistic films on LA. So, of course, there's the Rainer Banham.
Yeah.
And Tom Anderson.
Right.
But do you know this piece by someone called Elizabeth Waiter called Chatbook on the Non-Eminent?
No, never heard of that.
Yeah, from 93. And then another film by someone called Pat O'Neill from 89.
Oh, Water and Power?
Water and Power. Yeah.
I know that. That's quite good.
Okay, I'll have to give that a look.
Pat O'Neill was Chapbook on the Non-Imminent. What's this person's name? Liz what?
last name is W-I-A-T-R. However you want to pronounce that. Waiter.
Okay. W-I-A-T-R?
Yeah, no vowel between the T and the R.
That is wild. Cool. Yeah, Pat O'Neill's Water and Power, he's like an experiment. I think he started the experimental animation program at CalArts.
Okay, well, I got to see that then.
And it's very nice. It's very light and jazzy, and it's beautiful. And yeah, it's very easy to watch. You know who else was in that scene as well, whose animation thing I cannot get enough of? What's her name? She did the film Asparagus. Do you know this film?
No.
Susan Pitt. And I believe she, I might be wrong, but I think she was also an early experimental animation person at CalArts.
Excellent.
And she, yeah, starting in 1998. No, so she's not, she's maybe not a founder, but she was definitely there when we were there. But yeah, Susan Pitt, Asparagus, strongly recommend. It's totally weird. It like starts with like an animated like woman taking a poo. It's great. But it's really, really strange. And it's from 79. Yeah. It's great. Strongly recommend. 20 minutes long.
Well, let's leave him with that, Steve.
Yeah. Music was composed by Richard Teitelbaum.
Oh, that's going to be a humdinger.
Yeah. All right. Wow.
Wow.
Good night, Chinatown.
Good morning.